welcome everyone. Welcome to tonight's program. I always begin by quoting my guru, Swami Muktananda there. He would begin every program by saying in Hindi, Sabko bade sammane ke saath prem se hrdik swagat. With great love and respect, I welcome you all with all my heart. And he would always say that that's the essence of spirituality, to welcome another person with love. So in that spirit, I want to welcome you all. And also welcome everyone watching around the world on the global satsang. And tonight we have New York, Ann Arbor, and Canada, and Serbia, and India. I know that in Canada, Gauri and Mark are going to be with us in Ganeshpuri, yes. Right? Yes. And also Atmaram and Kashi from Ann Arbor. And also Japan. And Sahadev in Japan sent me a message that Govinda is on a fishing boat off Darwin, and he sends his love. And he's going to be with us in Ganeshpuri too, so. That's around the world, and then all around Australia in Adelaide, Brisbane, several places in Brisbane, Byron Bay and the Blue Mountains, Sunshine Coast, and in Mount Eliza. Very good. So I want to welcome you all. And I heard that Karuna is coming to Ganeshpuri. She's watching tonight. And who else is coming from Brisbane? Well, next time. Oh, and I know in Byron Bay, Oya is coming. Juryaji? Juryaji?
And Alina's probably coming too.
I just said that.
Alina
Karuna, that's Alina. And is Mr. Jagadish coming?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, Jagadish is watching too. Very good. And I don't know. I probably, if I've left you out, what's your problem? You could write me an email, an angry one. I'll mention you next week if it's polite. So, many years ago, when I had a very important moment in my life that led directly to a spiritual awakening, it was when I met the American yogi, Ram Dass. He'd been an academic and then he'd gone to India, and rich story. And I met him at a dinner party. And what came out of that night for me was one particular bit of knowledge, which was that there are great beings alive on the planet now. And that had great significance for me because, first of all, I could sort of accept that perhaps the Buddha was a great being 2,500 years ago. Perhaps Jesus was a great being 2,000 years ago. But who ever heard of any great beings except in biblical times, ancient times? And he was saying that there existed now great beings. And I knew that night that I wanted to go and meet one and learn from them, because I'd been an academic and I was working my PhD in teaching at university level, and I met a lot of intellectuals, but none of them seemed to know anything about what life was about. And so I thought great beings would be able to explain to me what this whole story is about. So that was the night I decided to go to India. And then I took his workshop that weekend, and he's talked about a particular yogi who became the first one that I really started to study. Because after hearing his talk about this yogi, I went out and got a book, which was Talks with Sri Ramana Maharshi. Because he was talking about Sri Ramana, or Sri Raman, who was possibly India's greatest, or most well-known sage of the 20th century. And Ram Dass explained that his method was to ask the question, who am I? And always look for a more profound answer to that question. Like you can begin by, you know, am I my personality? Well, no, you're not your personality. Am I my profession? No, you'd still be you, even with a different profession. And, you know, am I my family? Well, even if you didn't have your family, you'd still be you. And until you went back far enough in this inquiry to discover what was underlying that couldn't be reduced. It reminded me a little about Descartes' dialectic in the Western tradition, but he was going to find out who we are actually, most fundamentally. And that didn't have to do with our culture, our upbringing, even our male or femaleness or profession or religion or anything like that, or our ideas, our politics. Didn't have anything to do with any of that. Something more fundamental than that. So I got his book and I started reading it and didn't understand a word of it. It was way over my head. So, but since then I've always valued the great beings. And these programs are always centered on one of the great beings, the ones that make a lot of sense for me. So tonight it's that one I just mentioned, Sri Ramana Maharshi. And he became quite well known because for two reasons, two writers met him. One was an English journalist named Paul Brunton, who wrote a book, A Search in Secret India, which I devoured, by the way, at that time, where he meets various yogis and some great ones and some charlatans. But the outstanding chapter in the book is him meeting Ramana. This is Ramana. I think you can see the sweetness and the peace in his countenance. What else do you have of him? Yeah, there he is sitting with his devotees. Now, his story was quite amazing. The other writer, I should mention, was Somerset Maugham, the novelist. Any of you ever read The Razor's Edge? Or seen the movie The Razor's Edge? Which one did you see? The Bill Murray one. Don't see that one. There's one from with Tyrone Power in the 40s. Great, that's a great movie. And Bill Murray. Bill Murray's going... When you're agitated, who are you going to call? He says. That's something weird. I love Bill Murray, but that wasn't right for him. Anyway, so this is Ramana. Now, his story is extraordinary and can't help but arrest you, which is that he was a young boy in South India, and what was his age? 16, yeah, 16. I had a blank out for a minute. He's just a 16-year-old boy, high school boy, and one afternoon he suddenly actually had a spiritual experience out of nowhere. He was a pretty normal boy. He had one characteristic that he slept so deeply that no one could wake him sometimes. But other than that, he was a pretty normal, active kid, and he suddenly had this experience where he was gripped by a fear of death, and he thought he was going to die. And some of us have had this kind of experience. Usually what we do is we run for help, or we take a pill, or run to a doctor or something. But instead, he started to inquire, and he said, if my body dies, will I die? And he saw that there would be some part of him still left. And he did this inquiry, and according to his account, and he's written about it, he tells the story. It's only about a page long. It's marvelous. It was actually a seeing. It wasn't a rational process. It was like an intuitive process, at the end of which he was self-realized. At the age of 16, from 0 to 100 million in 30 seconds. In a 20-minute period, he became self-realized. People spend their whole lives pursuing this, and he did it in 20 minutes. He didn't even know he was self-realized. That's real self-realization, because he hadn't read any scriptures, so he didn't know anything, except he did know that he would sit in his room and try to do homework, and he would fall into a trance. And he was always in this high state. And then his brother came in, saw him in a trance on the bed, and he said, "Hey, you're such a yogi, why don't you go to the Himalayas?" And Ramana thought, "Yes, good idea." And so the next day he wrote a little note and he left. He completely left, and he went to a hill in South India called Arunachala, where he lived for the next 50 something years of his life. And he just camped out at the hill.
Had to get out of the heat.
Is it hot here?
Under the lights.
Oh, okay.
It's too hot for me. Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Excuse me, sorry.
Okay. Do you agree with everything I said so far?
No.
What part? Good. Anyway, so he left and he went there, and when he got there, he found a cave or something, and he fell into a trance, which actually lasted for a couple of years. And fortunately it wasn't the United States or somewhere, where people would think that he's a nutcase, or so put him in the loony bin. They said, "Oh, he's a holy man. Look at the young holy man." And so they woke him up to feed him, and his nails and his hair grew, and they cut it, you know, and they took care of him. And then after a couple of years, he sort of came out of it to a relative plane, and they started talking to him, asking him questions, and he didn't know any scriptures, so they read scriptures to him. And he would go, "I love this account." They'd read the scriptures, and he'd say, "Oh, yeah, that's right." It's good. He had the experience, then he was reading the scriptures. Usually it's the other way. And pretty soon the word got out and that there was a great, extraordinary sage there, and people came to him from all over the world. And so these are some dialogues from the book that I mentioned, which are less incomprehensible to me now, but I thought I'd share them with you. In the 20 minutes that he attained, oh, let's show him as a young yogi. This is shortly after he got to the Arunachala. There's so many great stories with it, like his family didn't know what had happened to him. He disappeared. He wrote a little note, said, "Don't worry about me, I'm on about my father's business." And they had no idea. And the mother was grieving, but they sort of canvassed places. They thought maybe he'd gotten religion and gone to an ashram or somewhere. And then word came back that a young man, meeting his description, was near this holy hill. So an uncle was sent down to see if it was him. And it was him. He said, "You've got to come home. Your mother's very upset." And he said, "No." And she ended up going there and spending the rest of her life living in the ashram. The father had died, and she lived in the ashram, and she became an important figure in it. So, and then his brother became the manager of the ashram later on. He gradually pulled his whole family there. So, yeah. Okay, so a question. A sannyasi asked, he taught the method of self-inquiry. In 20 minutes, he developed this method. He practiced it when he was faced with his own death and the question of who am I and going deeper, which is a subtle method. And most people who read about it don't really make any sense of it. But that's the method he always taught for the rest of his life. So they say that you have to teach the way you came, that otherwise it's theoretical. So if someone attains the self, the way they teach will be the way they attain the self. So this is the way he attained it, and that was his teaching. So Swami asks, "It is said that the self is beyond the mind, and yet the realization is with the mind." And then he quotes some Sanskrit stanzas. which say the mind cannot think it, the mind can't conceive the self. The self is too, is beyond the mind. It cannot be thought of by the mind, and the mind alone can realize it. How are these contradictions to be reconciled? So the mind can't do it, but without the mind, it can't be attained. And Ramana says, the self is realized with mruta manas, dead mind. That is, mind devoid of thoughts and turned inwards. So the mind's very useful. It's true, the mind is a lower evolute of the self. So the mind can't encompass the self, but the mind can point you towards the self. And so how does it point towards the self? By turning within and becoming still. He says, then the mind sees its own source and becomes that. It is not as the subject perceiving an object. So the mind usually is looking out and seeing objects and thinking about objects. But if the mind took its conscious quality and turned within and focused on its own source and stood there as the subject, as the I, then you would have inquiry. That would be what he's talking about. He says, when the room is dark, a lamp is necessary to illumine and eyes to cognize objects. But when the sun is risen, there is no need of a lamp, and the objects are seen. And to see the sun, no lamp is necessary. It is enough that you turn your eyes towards the self-luminous sun. So you don't need a torch to see the self. You need to turn towards the self. And when you turn towards the self, your first experience may be that there's nothing going on in there. It's black in there. Nothing happening. I can't find it. But if you let yourself quiet down and become still, you'll discover there's a very subtle but powerful light inside. And not only that, there's a powerful energy and a powerful love that's inside and you can come in contact with, but not if your mind is going crazy and roaring all kinds of fears and doubts and so on. So you have to learn to still it and then get in touch with it. He says, in the same way with the mind, to see the objects, the reflected light of the mind is necessary. To see the heart, it is enough that the mind is turned towards it. Then the mind loses itself and the heart shines forth. So the heart is the source of the mind. It's almost like the mind comes up out of the heart, starts going, look what's going on out there. He said that, she said that. And then, so shut up already, and turns within and focuses on the source. And this is a movement that we all can do, because the source is our own nature, our true nature. So according to Ramana, you don't have to build a self. The self is there. You just have to examine it. You have to look for it and get to it. You like that little dialogue? Here's another one, similar. Ramana further explained, the self is the heart. The heart is self-luminous. To be self-luminous means it's irreducible. In medieval philosophy, they used to call God the unmoved mover. That means that God caused the whole universe to happen, but nothing caused God to happen. And so self-luminous means it shines by its own light. That consciousness is the light that shines by its own light, not by another light. So he says, the heart is self-luminous. Light arises from the heart and reaches the brain, which is the seat of the mind. The world is seen with the mind, that is by the reflected light of the self. It's perceived with the aid of the mind. When the mind is illumined, it is aware of the world. If the mind is turned in towards the source of light, objective knowledge ceases and the self alone shines forth as the heart. So the mind is the moon, and the self is the heart, it's the source. Because we know the moon shines by the light of the sun. That's what he says. The moon shines by the reflected light of the sun. When the sun is set, the moon is useful for revealing objects. When the sun is risen, no one needs the moon, although the pale disk of the moon is visible in the sky. So it is with the mind and the heart. The mind is useful because of its reflected light. So the mind's very useful, but he's saying the mind borrows its consciousness from the source. That's how it can think and so on. But really, the source is the thing behind it. It's used for seeing objects. When it is turned inwards, the source of illumination shines forth by itself, and the mind remains dim and useless like the moon in daytime. That's another one. They both point in the same direction. This is the real meaning of his inquiry. It was to turn the mind inward and still it in the source, in the self. Want to try that for a second? Just take your mind. Your mind's thinking all kinds of thoughts, thinking about the past, thinking about the future, thinking about your relationships, thinking about what other people think, and wondering this, if you're looking cool or you're not looking cool, or, you know, if you look good in orange, thinking all these thoughts. And so instead of doing that, you just turn in on itself and just sit stillly with that focus. And when you do that subtly, you discover that there's a vibration which may be peaceful or joyous or loving. And that's real meditation. If that's difficult, you can use the mantra to do the same thing. You can use the mantra to dispel thoughts that come in and then go back to the source. Okay, another one. Only one more teacherly one, and then we'll have some fun. Okay, can you stand one more teacherly thing? I used to read this book and be constantly frustrated. I'd say, this is what he means. And I'd try that. And I'd say, that doesn't work. And it went on and on and on. But somehow I thought, this is there's an answer in this guy. This guy knows. I thought, this guy really knows, but I can't understand what he's saying. Anyway, a visitor asks about three methods of meditation mentioned in another book that Ramana had written. And this was about Raja Yoga. So Ramana pointed out that breath retention is an aid to control of the mind. That is the suppression of thoughts. Those of you who've done yoga know that it's called pranayama. It's a clever approach. Some people have a very hard time quieting the mind. Let me tell you a secret. Everybody has a hard time quieting the mind. But some people... You got something? Will this help? Will this really help?
Yes, so it says the doctor. But,
Wow, what's in that? Everything's shimmering. It's all like connected, man. So, before I met Baba, I studied with Haridas Baba, who recently passed away at a very advanced age. But his main teaching was pranayama, or different methods of breath control. There'd be different rhythms, sometimes very fast rhythms, sometimes slow. And the idea was ultimately to quiet the mind through the breath, because breath and mind are strongly related. So Ramana says, one person may practice breath control, inhalation, exhalation, and retention, or retention only. These are three parts of the movement of breath. One is the in-breath, and then the out-breath, and then the breath is held either inside or outside. That's called kumbhak, is to hold the breath either inside. You notice it, breathe in and hold the breath. You notice that the mind becomes still. Or at least stiller. Isn't that true? And you can also try holding it out. So yogis have always used breath control as a way of calming the mind. He says, another type of practicing meditator on controlling the mind controls the breath, and its retention automatically results. So sometimes people experience spontaneous kumbhak, which means they're meditating and suddenly the breath stops. And people get really scared. But it's safe, you know, it'll come back. But this sometimes happens. And then another one, watching the inhalation, exhalation is also breath control. And this was Baba's favorite method, called hamsa or soham. You just watch the breath come in and go out. You watch it come in and go out. And this is breath control, actually, pranayama, most sophisticated one. You just watch the breath, and it brings the mind to stillness. And Ramana says, these methods are only apparently threefold. They're in fact really one, because they lead to the same goal. They are, however, differently adopted according to the stage of the aspirant and his antecedent predispositions or tendencies. Really, there are only two methods. Ready? Inquiry and devotion. One leads to the other. There are basic two methods. He would say this again and again. Inquiry and devotion. And they're actually two different kinds of movements. So in inquiry, it's a deconstruction. What is that postmodern? You deconstruct everything. You deconstruct yourself as a person. You deconstruct your mind and emotions until you get down to what's underneath it all, whether you call that a void or a self, until you get to the bottom. That's a moving backwards, and that's a method of wisdom, of yan. You keep deconstructing. That's not me, that's not me, that's not it. And then you're... And the other is a movement, a positive movement towards something. That's devotion. Devotion is devotion towards something higher, towards a deity, a guru, towards a principle, towards consciousness. And that you move towards that. And both are valid. And I think that everyone can practice both of these methods. Sometimes one, sometimes the other. So anyway, the seeker, having heard that great teaching, he says one leads to the other. If you're a great devotee and worship the deity, eventually it'll lead to inquiry. And if you do inquiry, you'll eventually get to the deity, the higher principle. The devotee says, seeking the eye, there is nothing to be seen. That's a whinge. I'm trying to focus, find the eye, and I can't find it. And Ramana says, because you're accustomed to identify yourself with the body and the sight with the eyes, therefore you say you do not see anything. What is there to be seen? Who is to see? How to see? There's only one consciousness, which manifesting as I thought, identifies itself with the body projects itself through the eyes and sees the objects around. The individual is limited in the waking state and expects to see something different. The evidence of the senses will be the seal of authority. But he will not admit that the seer, the seen, and the sight are all manifestations of the same consciousness, namely I. So he's saying that this whole world is one consciousness. What the seer, that's you, and then the agent of seeing, your eyes, and then what you see are all really one. It's all involved in one conscious movement. This is very subtle, and you have to contemplate that. He says, realize it, and that is the truth. So he's categorical. He's saying that it's true that there's really only one consciousness taking all these forms, and because there are all these forms, it confuses us. And then we see something and we separate from it and we get scared of it. But really there's only one here. Devotee, on inquiry into the origin of thoughts, there is a perception of I, but it does not satisfy me. It's another more sophisticated winch. And Ramana says, quite right. The perception of I is associated with a form, maybe the body. There should be nothing associated with the pure self. The self is the unassociated, pure reality, in whose light the body, ego, etc. shine. On stilling all thoughts, the pure consciousness remains over. That's very far out, saying that your own awareness, examine your own awareness, is basically saying. Your own awareness. You have an awareness, right? Admit it. And it's connected to your personhood, but it's not really. You can let the personhood go and come back to the awareness itself in its pure and pristine form. It's always been there. That awareness has always been there in your whole life, every moment. And you may have changed your whole philosophy. You may have been a Trump supporter, and then now you're maybe not, or maybe you weren't, and now you are. And yet the same awareness is there through both, see, so it's prior to that. He says, just on waking from sleep and before becoming aware of the world, there is pure I, just as you wake up. Before you come back, there's a moment. Hold on to it without sleeping or without allowing thoughts to possess you. If that is held firm, it does not matter, even though the world is seen. So then he's saying, if you know that space, it doesn't matter if you look at the world then, because you're always in that space. The seer remains unaffected by the phenomena. Isn't that great stuff? It's great stuff. Did you understand it? Don't say no. Did you understand something from it? Something.
Yes.
It may be this small size of a pea, or it may be the size of a great vast ocean. It's what if you took something from it, that's what's important. See, this is nothing, his teaching is nothing but grace. And so instead of saying, I didn't understand it, because you can't understand it with the mind. You can't, you have to practice and then but if you got something or some inspiration to do a practice or to investigate, then it's worth it. You have to take a positive view. Did you get something? A little something?
Mm-hmm.
Good, prove it to me. Prove it. Come on. Prove it. I dare you. Tell me what little bit. Go ahead. Yep.
And I like that because the way that the originating energy comes up from the heart, and that mind's useful, but it's...
can you actually see it moving up from the heart to the up to the head?
Not in... the imagery that...
You like it, yeah.
Helps me.
Great.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Who else? That's wonderful. Who? Madame.
When you were speaking of meditation to get in touch with the deepest part of the self, first approach was to move deeper and deeper inside towards the divine, towards the, or
what you see saying what? What I was speaking?
The two types of meditation to know the self.
While I was speaking, you were saying?
Yeah.
You weren't listening then?
Yes, I get it wrong.
I'm kidding you. No, that's beautiful.
Devotion and inquiry.
Huh? It began inquiry, yeah. Yeah, well, you hear Ramana and an inquiry starts automatically.
Ramana.
He had a lot of trouble because his girlfriend said, every time I see her, I just start inquiring. So he couldn't hold the girlfriend. Oh, one more? I love these. Anything, however small, I love it. The magic of these teachings are they're amazingly universal, and they come from a very high place, and everyone hears them differently. But whatever you hear is valid for you. Yes, sir?
That moment when you wake up.
Yeah.
Where you're just there and there's not really any identification at that point. Occasionally that sort of happens to me in meditation as well. I realize after the fact that I was there, my mind kicks in, and I experience mind kicking in. I suppose the mind kicking in makes me know that my mind wasn't active.
Yeah. You know, you ever have a thing like, who am I today? Who am I now? I don't know. Okay, great. I always like it to, just so you know that Ramana wasn't just a self-inquiry machine. I usually put in a personal anecdote. This is a devotee's story. One K.K. Nambiar, who was chief engineer highways in Madras. He wrote a book about his time with Ramana. And he writes, in 1932, when I was an engineer in Salem, somewhere in India, a friend of mine left me with the booklet, Who Am I? In Malayalam. So Who Am I was a little booklet, a very short booklet in which Ramana's teaching, he gave it. There was a mention of a living Maharshi, or Maharishi, in the book. I had heard of the Maharshis in the Puranas, that's in the scripture, and doubted there could be one in flesh and blood living these days. Very similar to my experience, isn't it? Except that I knew that there was one suddenly. A few days later, when I mentioned about the booklet to Chaitiyar, president of the Salem District Board, he confirmed the existence of the Maharshi, and a trip was arranged to Trivandrumalai, which is where he was. We went to Sri Raman Ashram, to his ashram. On entering the hall, I prostrated before the Maharshi. Though no words passed between us, I felt an indescribable influence and a sense of calmness settling over me. I sat transfixed to the spot. Chaitiyar got up after about an hour and signaled it was time to go. We took leave of Bhagavan, they call him Bhagavan, who nodded assent. So he got in his presence, and the Shakti, his energy, the saint radiated, affected him immediately. He says, while leaving the ashram, I felt that my heart was being irresistibly attracted, as though by a mighty spiritual magnet, towards that divinity in human form seated on the couch. My feeling at that time can best be expressed in the words of the poet Kalidas. The body goes forward, but the restless heart runs backward, like the cloth of a banner which is being carried against the wind. I prayed fervently that I might be granted more opportunities to be with him. My prayer was answered. I was posted as district board engineer of North Arcot with headquarters in Trivandrumalai. So he's a civil servant, and he lets you know his position. He's quite proud of it. And then he got posted nearby. He says, and this is very cute, during one of my trips to the ashram, I made a contribution towards a bhiksha We call him a bandara, where the devotee buys the food for a particular feast. So he sponsors the feast for all the ashramites. This meant feeding all ashramites and visitors sumptuously. Bhagavan also partook of the meal along with the others. People started queuing into the dining hall, and I chanced to sit right in front of Bhagavan, who gave me a gracious smile. I can still recall the ecstasy I felt while taking my meal right in front of Bhagavan, less than a yard separating our leaf plates. That was the happiest meal in my life. This is devotion, see? By now, my skepticism about a living Maharshi had vanished like mist before the rising sun. My attitude towards work and play was undergoing a beneficial change. I gave up hunting, vowing that I would not kill any animals. So he's already had improvement. People who visited Bhagavan during his lifetime could not have failed to observe the characteristic pose in which he reclined on the sofa with eyes closed and his head supported with his left arm, particularly at the time of the Veda chanting of the Vedas. The Brahmins would chant the Vedas, and he would recline. Some of us devotees sitting around used to watch him intently during such periods. And we got a few pictures of him there. There's a little creature on his thigh there, which is a frog, is it? It's a squirrel. Oh, we saw that before, didn't we? He had intense relationships with all the animals around the ashram. It's a little squirrel. What? There was a story. What was it, about the nuts? Yeah. Here you come. See, is that how relaxed Ramana is, huh?
It's a chipmunk.
And next. Always leans on his left arm, it seems. Yeah. And one more.
Nice pose.
What?
Nice pose.
Nice pose. So the devotee says, on several occasions, I used to pray mentally to him that on opening his eyes, he should bestow a look at me. And I must say, I was never disappointed. So it was crystal clear to me that prayers to Bhagavan need not be vocal. And he felt, knew, and answered the inner prayer of all his devotees. So that's the devotee. Sweet, huh? Well, I had a couple more. Let me see. I got two reminiscences by devotees, one about walking around the hill and the other taking a yatra. You have, they're short. You want one? Yes. Which one?
Yatra.
What?
Yatra.
You want the yatra? Okay. It's all very emotional, too. Okay. Yatra means a pilgrimage, a trip. He says, this was S.S. Cohen, who we heard from, who's a Western devotee. After 3 years' stay at the ashram, I got Bhagavan's permission to go on a yatra to the south. He smiled approval and inquired about the date and time of my starting and whether I'd made arrangements for my stay in various places of my visit. Extremely touched by his solicitude, I answered I was going as a sadhu, trusting to chance for accommodation. What does that mean, going as a sadhu?
Holy man.
What?
Holy man.
Begging.
Beggar. Holy man.
Begging?
Yeah, but it's... but Kosting is a hippie, a spiritual hippie, a wandering holy man who just goes and takes food he can and, you know, stays where he stays. So he'd gone native. He'd dressed up in native garb and wandered around. During my leisurely tour of South India, I visited temples and stayed in holy places for long or short durations as the spiritual mood took me. Everywhere I was well received. Wherever I went, Bhagavan's name acted like a charm, particularly as I'd adopted the Indian dress from the beginning. This is 1936. I even for the time discarded the wearing of footwear, bathed in Hindu bathing tanks and attended evening temple worship with the smearings on my arms and forehead. I don't recommend going around without, even if you get gripped by the madness, don't go around without shoes. During my yatra, I used to plunge in reflections on Bhagavan's blissful silence and calm repose. I think you could see that in those pictures, the calm repose. The stillness of his mind haunted me wherever I went. I felt his influence in the depth of my soul. And I cried, "Oh Bhagavan, how mighty you are, and how sublime and all-pervasive is the immaculate purity of your mind. With what tender emotions do we, your students, think of your incomparable qualities, your gentleness, your serene, adorable countenance, your cool, refreshing smiles, the sweetness of the words that come out of your mouth." As you contemplate him, you see that it's true. There's a great sweetness about him and a great peacefulness about him, stillness. "The radiance of all your embracing love, your equal vision towards one and all, even towards stray animals." So he was getting into spiritual moods doing that. So this is Ramana. It's a mistake to think he's just an inquiry machine. He also was an ocean of love. So let's meditate. And we can do a little bit of inquiry in the meditation. We'll meditate for 10 minutes. And the goal of meditation is our own self, or rather your own self. Because what the sages say, that within every person there is a place of complete peace, complete joy, and vibrant energy and love. And that's within every single person. No matter what has happened in our life, whatever traumas we've gone through, whatever difficulties we've gone through, that space has not been destroyed or affected. And anytime we want to, we can turn within and get in touch with that space. And as we become expert in getting in touch with that space, we become more and more centered in that space. And the more centered we are in that space, lo and behold, the more our life starts to work in our external life. We handle things much better. Our emotions are more peaceful. Our relationships become better, and so on. So let's turn within. The basic question is, who am I? But really, we're moving from the mind to the heart, from the moon to the sun. We're trying to find out what is at the basis of who we are. Place of stillness, peace, and joy. Whatever means that you can to get in touch with that place, do that. Or else you can use the mantra of our tradition. Repeat, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, and let other thoughts disappear. So let's meditate now for 10 minutes. And once again, with great love, I welcome you all with all my heart. Satguru Nath, Raj, EJ. Let's meditate.